This interview with Dr. Anna Watts of the Max Planck Institute for Astrophysics is part of the January 2008 Jodcast. For the full show and the archive, go to www.jodcast.net.
So your research is in magnetars?
Well, my research is neutron star spin and vibrations.
Okay.
So I've done some stuff to do with spin. It's mainly neutron star oscillations of all kinds.
Mm-hmm.
And so the magnetar stuff is part of that. And then I'm also starting to look at other areas, gravitational wave vibrations, that kind of thing as well.
Remind us a little bit about what a neutron star is.
Okay, so a neutron star is an extremely compact object, essentially formed entirely of neutrons. It is formed in the aftermath of a supernova explosion of a star that is perhaps 10 times more massive than our own sun.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially it's collapsed. You have a mass, perhaps about 1 to 2 solar masses, basically crushed down into an area. I always say the size of the Isle of Wight. I could say the size of Manchester, but it's really crushed down so that actually the nuclei and the atoms essentially have dissolved. And all you're left with are neutrons and protons crushed together directly.
And what do these things do?
Well, they have extremely extreme nuclear physics properties. These are the best laboratories we can possibly come up with for extreme physics. Okay, first of all, because they are so dense and so compact, we have to worry about the effects of general relativity. We're packing a lot of mass together into a very, very small volume.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we always have to worry about relativity when we do our calculations. Because we're dealing with stuff at such high density, we're really into the realms where nuclear physics is totally unknown. We call them neutron stars. They might not actually be neutron stars. We really don't know what happens at these kind of densities. The neutrons themselves may be dissolving into their constituent quarks. So there's an awful lot of uncertainty as to what actually lives on the inside of these stars. So great laboratories for nuclear physics. They have the strongest magnetic fields that we know about. They're about 10 orders of magnitude greater than anything we can create in a laboratory on Earth, even for a very short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So hugely strong magnetic fields, and they're also extremely fast rotators. We know of neutron stars that spin up to 760 odd times per second. So this is pretty fast. So we're dealing with, you know, very dense, very compact objects spinning extremely rapidly.
Mm-hmm. Why is this interesting physics?
Well, I think it's interesting physics, so purely because we cannot possibly test these things in the laboratory here on Earth. So essentially what a neutron star, and in fact all compact stars, are allowing us to do is to test our theories somewhere else. You know, we want to see what happens when we get beyond our own planet. You know, we're going to crazy densities, crazy spin rates, you know, crazy amounts of relativity, and we want to see what happens. So hopefully we're getting to the point where our theories start to break down. And it's interesting to push all our theories to see where they break.
How do we observe neutron stars?
Okay, well, you can examine them in all different kinds of wavelengths. They were discovered as radio pulsars, and this was regular pulses of radio beams from rapidly spinning objects. We now see them in the X-rays, and the sort of stars that I look at quite often are seen in the X-ray. We've looked at them in optical, in infrared, so you see them in all kinds of electromagnetic wave bands, and hopefully in the very near future, we will also start to see them in gravitational waves as well. Because they're such compact objects, if a neutron star vibrates a little bit and its gravitational field changes, it's going to emit reasonably strong gravitational waves.
Hmm. How do you observe these things in X-rays?
Okay, so we fortunately have to use satellites. Being an X-ray astronomer is not a ticket to taking you to nice telescopes. Unfortunately, the atmosphere blocks out X-rays, so we have to launch satellites and sit in darkened offices rather than in nice telescope locations in Hawaii or Chile or somewhere. The real workhorse, as far as I've been concerned, is the Rossi X-ray Timing Explorer. That's an X-ray satellite that was launched, I think, nearly 11 years ago now, that basically picks up X-ray photons from these particular objects.
Mm.
So the reason you're seeing X-rays from these things is because they're accreting from a companion.
Right. So these neutron stars are actually in a binary system. They have a star in an orbit around it doing what?
Well, essentially, neutron stars come in two classes. Some of them are isolated, some of them are in binaries. Okay, so the X-ray pulsars, we essentially see them. So the companion star is orbiting around the neutron star, and because the neutron star has such a strong gravitational field, it's actually sucking matter off the companion.
Mm-hmm.
As this matter spirals in towards the neutron star, it forms a disk of material around the star, and this gas and dust gets very, very hot, and then it emits in the X-rays. And that's why we see the X-ray emission from these systems.
Would we see these things as a pulsar as well, a radio pulsar as well, or is something different going on?
Well, it seems to be the case that either you see them in X-rays or you see them in radio. So the accreting systems are not generally seen in radio, probably because the fact that you have all this kind of gas and stuff around things actually blocks the radio emission. So there's now some tentative detections of radio emission from these systems, thought to come from perhaps a jet of material being launched from the surface of the star, but generally we don't get radio pulsations, unfortunately. But we do get X-ray pulsations.
What do you learn from your X-ray pulses that you see? So material gets dumped onto the neutron star, or rather onto the accretion disk, and emits some X-rays. What do you learn about the neutron star?
Okay, well, it depends what you start looking at. So for some systems, it looks like as the material falls in towards the star, it's basically scooped up by the magnetic field of the star and channeled towards the magnetic poles. So you can think of these as the poles of a bar magnet stuck within the star. Then as the star spins, you see these kind of hot spots of X-rays swinging past you. So you can actually look again at the regular pattern of pulsations and get the spin period of the star, so you know how fast it's rotating. That starts to tell you all kinds of interesting things about what it's made of. For example, if a neutron star was too soft, as you spun it more and more rapidly, it would actually fly apart. So we can start to say, all right, well, it has to be at least made of these constituents, otherwise it would fly apart if it was rotating that fast. Other things we can do are to start to model what the pulsations look like. The pulsation shape is set by all kinds of interesting things, like the gravitational field strength at the surface of the star. And you can start to look at gravitational light bending, see what relativity is doing to your light curve. So you can try and work out the gravitational field strength. Again, the real goal here is to try and pick out the mass and radius of the star, because that tells you what the nuclear physics inside must be doing.
Right. Is the material being dumped onto the neutron star or onto the accretion disk, is that constant? Does that happen all the time? Or does it turn on, turn off? What happens?
Essentially, material is always being transmitted into the accretion disk. Okay, we assume that most of these systems, material is constantly flowing into the accretion disk. The question is then whether it's flowing from the accretion disk onto the neutron star. Some systems, it seems that they're always on. Material is always processing, you know, through the accretion disk and onto the star. That's not true for all systems. Some of them are what we call transient. The transient systems seem to switch on and off. Sometimes the disk is unstable and matter is falling in towards the neutron star, and sometimes it's perfectly stable, the whole system disappears in X-rays, and the accretion process seems to stop.
Does matter actually get stuck on the neutron star? Does the neutron star get heavier in this process, or does it all get radiated away in some form of energy?
No, it will be getting heavier. It takes a long time to make a neutron star much heavier, but yet it will be getting heavier over time.
So the question we could ask is, how long will it take for a neutron star accreting matter like this to become a black hole? Because a neutron star is almost a black hole, right, in terms of its mass.
Well, then the big question is, how big can a neutron star get? And what mass are they born with? And those are not questions that we know the answers to yet. Because the nuclear physics is so uncertain, there's no really great upper limits on how big a neutron star can be. So that's a really open question, and we don't know the answer to it yet.
Could you answer it through these observations, do you think?
If you can pin down what the right nuclear physics is, then yes, you might be able to. So, but that's really the main game in neutron star astrophysics, at least as far as I'm concerned, is figure out what the nuclear physics inside is doing.
Right.
And trying to find various ways of doing that.
How else can you investigate what a neutron star is made of, or this internal physics? You mentioned something about gravitational waves. Tell us about what a gravitational wave is.
Okay, so gravitational waves are emitted when objects change their gravitational field. It's essentially some way of letting the rest of the universe know that the gravitational field has changed. So one particular idea with a neutron star is that if you set it vibrating in some way, as it vibrates, its gravitational field will change. And as that happens, gravitational waves have to be emitted to the rest of the universe to tell the universe that the gravitational field is changing. Mm-hmm. So you should see some kind of periodic gravitational wave signal, if you can detect it, to tell you this is happening.
Let's ask first the obvious question. What is a gravitational wave? What's waving?
Okay, essentially, the standard argument is that it's a vibration in space-time. That, I don't think, really tells you particularly very much. So let's talk about what would happen if a gravitational wave went through you. If one flows through me sitting here, essentially what will happen is I will be made alternatively taller and then slightly broader and then taller and broader again. So it's stretching me The length scales and also the time scales as well.
Essentially, space itself is being stretched in different directions as this wave goes past.
Exactly.
Hmm. What do you experience yourself? Do you feel yourself getting stretched in one direction and then in another direction?
Well, fortunately, gravitational waves are going to be so weak that you would probably never, ever feel it. The one really challenging thing about finding gravitational waves is that they're extremely difficult to detect. They don't interact very much with matter. Okay, so this is, you know, really, really hard things to try and find. There are a whole host of experiments operating now, like LIGO and GEO, for example, big detectors trying to look for these very, very tiny shifts in space-time. And fortunately for you or I, even if a neutron star blew up next door, you know, we're not going to be destroyed by this kind of thing, at least not by the gravitational waves.
Tell us how these experiments work.
The current experiments are all ground-based. What you have essentially are two perpendicular arms, and you fire a laser up and down each one. You send the laser light up to the end, reflect it, and send it back. And then you recombine it and see if essentially the waves still add together, or whether one of them has traveled a tiny little bit further suddenly, and things are not quite adding up perfectly when you put the laser light back together.
And this is because space itself has been stretched in one particular direction.
Exactly, exactly. So you're looking for tiny stretches of the arms, seeing what happens, and seeing if you can then recombine things.
Is it working yet?
The experiments are working. LIGO is at its design sensitivity. They haven't found anything yet. So the question, I guess, now is what is going to be the first thing that they find? I guess probably the most likely signal that they will get first is the gravitational waves emitted by two black holes orbiting each other. It's a much stronger source. It's probably going to be much more likely. In terms of vibrations from neutron stars, the predictions are that the signals will be a lot weaker. It's probably unlikely we'll see something with the current generation of detectors, but maybe with the next instantiation, we might see something. So there are lots of plans to upgrade these things. But gravitational waves are going to be difficult. So one of the questions is, can we do better with other sources, perhaps not looking at gravitational waves?
Like what, for instance?
Perhaps to try and introduce the field that I've been working on most recently. Actually, the best way for me to start with this is to start not in the stars, but to start here on Earth. So on the 26th of December 2004, there was a catastrophic earthquake off the western coast of Sumatra that launched the devastating tsunami. Mm-hmm. Now, in the aftermath of that event, in addition to all the humanitarian stuff, there were seismologists going to work to study this earthquake. And what they did was two things. So first of all, they looked at the transient behavior associated with the event. So look at your seismographs, look at the vibrations, work back to figure out where the crust fractured. You know, where was the earthquake? How deep was it? How fast was it? And so on. The second thing, because this is such a powerful earthquake, it actually set the whole surface of the planet ringing. So the whole of the Earth started ringing like a bell.
Of course, we didn't hear this.
No. For days and days afterwards, it was vibrating gently. Mm-hmm. Okay, and you can look at the frequencies of that, the decay rates and so on, and use that to infer things about what the Earth is made of. Mm. Now, less than 48 hours after that, the Earth got hit by the brightest bunch of gamma rays that's ever been recorded. And the source of that event was a starquake on a neutron star. And a neutron star with an incredibly strong magnetic field, what we call a magnetar. And after this starquake, looking in the afterglow, in the X-rays, astronomers discovered the first hints of seismic vibrations from the neutron star, in exactly the same way that they'd found these global vibrations of the Earth.
Right.
So this was done by a group of Italian astronomers led by Gianluca Israel. So this was really exciting. I guess people like myself had always assumed that we might have to wait for gravitational waves to come along to start doing neutron star seismology. But here we have something in X-rays and gamma rays vibrating away after a catastrophic starquake. And we can start to study it, you know, we can start to study this now.
What is a starquake, though? I mean, a star isn't like the planet Earth. The planet Earth has got sort of solid bits stuck on a fluid center, let's say. But a star is a big ball of gas, right? How does a star quake?
Not a neutron star. A neutron star is actually a good deal more like the Earth. So I guess our current picture of what a neutron star is made of, on the interior you have what you can call a nuclear fluid. So perhaps neutrons that behave like a superfluid, because they're simply so dense, it's like a gloopy fluid of neutrons. So we have a fluid core of some kind. As you get towards the outer layers, where the pressures start to fall off, you form a solid crust. Now, the solid crust, if you start from the outside and move in, On the outside, I have pretty much normal nuclei. Okay, everything's still hanging together. As things get more and more squashed, as I go deeper, neutrons start to leak out of the nuclei. Okay, so everything starts to break down and get squashed as you go towards this deep crust. So essentially, in a neutron star, you do have a crust and a core.
So it's very similar to the solid shell around a fluid thing. And what causes the quake?
Okay, so in these particular stars, they have extremely strong magnetic fields. So a standard radio pulsar, you would have perhaps a magnetic field about 10 to the 12 Gauss. For a magnetar, we're talking a magnetic field about 100, perhaps 1,000 times stronger than that. Okay, so these are really unusual objects, quite a small population. Mm-hmm. And then the picture is that over time, the magnetic field starts to decay. And actually, the field lines, if you think about the field lines of a bar magnet, they start to twist as things start to decay. And as they twist up, they get tangled. And eventually you get to the stage where the whole system is unstable. And what the star really wants to do is for these magnetic field lines to break and reconnect, okay, to a more stable configuration. And it's very similar to the process that launches solar flares, okay, as the sun's magnetic field gets tangled. When the field lines break and reconnect, we get a burst of gamma rays.
Right.
And these stars emit very regular bursts of gamma rays, mm-hmm. mostly quite small scale, but we see them. Very rarely, we get an absolutely huge burst of gamma rays. And this was the type of event that we saw this time round. These events are at least 1,000 times stronger than the normal flares. And I guess the picture is it's more like a large-scale earthquake, a magnitude 9 earthquake. Suddenly, these tiny reconnections don't get you out of trouble. And the whole magnetic field is so unstable that the only thing the star can do is for the whole configuration to change. You know, every magnetic field line snaps at once, the whole configuration shifts, and you get a huge, huge burst of gamma rays coming off the star.
And from these gamma rays, you can then tell what the essentially the seismic activity was on this neutron star.
Absolutely.
And that presumably means that you can figure out what the neutron star is made of.
So that's what we've now been trying to do. It's a complicated problem. We're dealing with a very difficult system, complicated nuclear physics. So, but yeah, essentially what we're trying to do is to figure out the internal composition. So we've taken a look at the frequencies that we've seen. For the 2004 event, we know the neutron star emitted at least 7 different notes or frequencies, ranging from 18 hertz up to 1800. So to put that in context, middle C is around 260 hertz.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so we've got a whole range of different notes. We then looked at another giant flare from back in 1998, found the same kind of things in the afterglow, and we have at least 4 different notes from that neutron star. So then the question is, what are they? You know, can we work out what type of vibrations we're actually seeing? So I think we're getting there. What we think we are seeing, first of all, there is a component from the neutron star's crust. So essentially, it's a twisting motion of the neutron star's crust. So rather than vibrating in and out, the crust is actually literally twisting without moving in and out, and we see that shifting to and fro. We also have a component from the fluid core of the neutron star, and again, it's a twisting motion, and the reason why we see this is because of this hugely strong magnetic field. If I try and twist that, it wants to twist back, and it starts vibrating. There's a lot of complicated physics working out how this fluid core couples into the crust. How are the two joined together?
Yes.
You know, why do we see the particular frequencies that we see? But essentially, we're seeing, you know, both a component from the crust and from the core itself.
There's an intermediate step, though. It's not exactly the same as looking at an earthquake on Earth, because we're measuring the actual waves or the motion of material going wobble, wobble, wobble as the earthquake passes and as the Earth itself does its ringing thing. Yeah. On your neutron stars, though, on these magnetars, you are converting the seismic activity into a gamma ray release, and you've got to work back from the gamma rays to what's happening on the crust. How hard is that?
That's one of the biggest questions that we have. How on earth are we seeing these things? You know, just because I am shaking the surface of the star, why on earth should I see anything, basically, in the X-rays and gamma rays? So I think the best picture right now is, if you can imagine, I have my magnetic field lines on the star basically sticking through the crust into the core. I mean, you can imagine it, if you like, as carpet fibers. Okay, so it's fibers sticking up from the carpet. I'm shaking the carpet around, and these fibers are shaking around as well. And so the idea would be that as I'm shaking the magnetic field lines to and fro, Basically, I'm getting little extra bursts of gamma rays on a periodic fashion as I'm doing it.
The frequency of the gamma rays that you see mm-hmm. here on Earth is directly related to the frequency of the neutron star.
Yeah, we think so. So there's a little bit of drift around. So if you can imagine, the notes that we hear is not entirely pure notes. It seems to drift around a little bit, but it's pretty stable over a long period of time, so for 100 seconds or so. So it looks like there's some kind of stable clock, vibrating clock, if you like, underneath this whole system. Then the question is, okay, well, what happens as I try and transmit that information outwards? The drift is an interesting phenomenon. It could be to do with the emission mechanism of why we see these things. However, there's another possibility, and it's because of the way that the core and the crust have to tie together. And actually, if you try and model these things, you can get frequency drifts purely because of the weirdness of how this fluid magnetic core has to tie in with the crust. You can imagine it like essentially having two pendulums coupled together. Okay, so I start vibrating one, it gradually starts moving the other one, that one starts to move, and gradually they move to and fro.
How many of these systems do you know of?
Well, we have two that have shown vibrations, and that is it. In terms of magnetar systems, basically there are a few more than 10. Not a huge number of systems. These high magnetic field systems that burst regularly seem to be very, very rare. They come in two classes. They're soft gamma repeaters, or SGRs, which seem to burst fairly regularly. And there were also a class of stars called anomalous X-ray pulsars. We now know that these two classes are probably the same. We just caught them at different times in their lives. They now seem to show pretty similar behavior. But basically, we don't have a lot of stars to play with.
Can we discover more?
Well, we think we've probably found all the ones nearby that are going to burst. There are other stars that may be magnetars that aren't bursting at the moment, so it's possible that at some point they may start. But I think some of the estimates are that we've probably found all the ones that we're going to find nearby.
But at least you've got several different ways of investigating the same objects, right? I mean, you have your gamma ray observations, you have gravitational wave observations as well. Hopefully.
Yeah,
soon.
Hopefully. That's true. So one of the nice things we can do, and we're starting to do this now, so in addition to these gigantic explosions, okay, which really give us a lot of information, as I said, these stars also emit very, you know, regular small-scale flares. Think of them more like regular small earthquakes, okay, perhaps magnitude 4 or 5 earthquakes. So one question we've had is, well, are they vibrating after this as well? And if you look at the mathematics, then it's possible. The energies are about right. You might be able to trigger, you know, small-scale vibrations afterwards. Whether we can see them or not is a difficult question, but we've been looking at a very detailed search, essentially to take all this small data from the small flares and try and look for vibrations after that as well.
Very exciting research.
Well, I think why it's exciting is the potential. So because we now have these different vibrations, we can now start to figure out what the neutron star is made of. So that's been particularly thrilling.
Why are we all caught up in the fact that it has to be a neutron in the neutron star? Why is a neutron star has got to be made up only of neutrons? I mean, that seemed to be fairly standard theory for quite some time. And now you're telling us that it may not be?
Well, I was traumatized on the first day of my doctoral research when I discovered that neutron stars may not just contain neutrons. I think the nuclear physics people have known for a long time that it's likely to be more complicated.
It's a conspiracy of nuclear theorists. They weren't telling the rest of us.
And actually, it's even worse than that. They may not be neutron stars at all. There could actually be no neutrons in a neutron star. One hypothesis has been that they're actually strange stars. So rather than having neutrons, which are made up of up and down quarks, and we have a kind of horrible mix of strange quarks, up and down quarks, in the middle of these things. And in fact, there are no neutrons there at all. And that's quite possible.
How distinguishable would that be, given the data that you're getting and the analysis that you're getting? Would it be very clear whether a star was one of these strange objects made up of strange quarks, up and down quarks, as opposed to what we currently like to think of as, you know, a basic neutron star made of, believe it or not, neutrons? Is that going to be clear from your data, hopefully?
Well, it may be. So one of the real challenges for a long time has been finding good observational signatures, okay, that will distinguish neutron stars from strange stars. Strange stars are probably thought to have smaller radii. Okay, so the radius of the star, overall its volume is smaller. Mm-hmm. Similar masses, but smaller volume. The difficulty that we have is that where we can measure neutron star mass quite reasonably, it's extremely difficult to measure neutron star radius. And these are tiny, tiny objects. you know, they're very far away. We can't resolve the disk of the star, so you can't measure the radius. You have to try and guess it from looking at other measurements. So picking out the radius has been really, really challenging.
How would you measure the radius of a neutron star?
Well, you can do several things. One thing, for example, is to look at the rate at which it's cooling. So that's related to the surface area of the star. Unfortunately, it's also related to the nuclear physics inside, so you start from problem one again. Mm-hmm. You can also try and infer it, for example, by looking for emission lines, perhaps, from the surface of the star and picking things up from there. It's all very model dependent, so it's a very, very difficult thing to do. So that's where we hope seismology might make a difference. One quite exciting thing is that strange stars have different crusts. They may not have crusts at all. You may just have a ball of strange quark matter fluid, which is pretty horrible. Or alternatively, you may have a crust, but it will be different to a neutron star crust. They tend to be much thinner, so that makes a difference to the type of frequencies and the type of vibrations you can excite. So one thing we've just finished doing is to calculate essentially the natural frequencies for a strange star crust for the various different models. And actually, it's very hard to explain our observations if it's a strange star.
Okay.
So we're certainly not at the final answer. This is a horrible problem in physics, but we're getting there. And I think this might be a very, very good way to tell the difference between the two types of star.
Have you managed to measure anything about these neutron stars yet?
So yeah, one of the things we think we've managed to measure is the thickness of the neutron star's crust. What we're seeing when we see these vibrations is essentially the whole crust essentially moving sideways and vibrating back. So you can imagine for the lowest frequencies, the whole crust essentially is shifting as one slab sideways and then back again. Mm-hmm. As we go to the higher frequencies, we come across what are called radial overtones. So now you can imagine that essentially I've fixed a point in the middle of the crust, okay, halfway down, and the top half of the crust is moving one way and the bottom is going the other way.
Right.
And so this vibrates a little bit faster and we get a higher frequency. Mm. Now that frequency depends directly on the thickness of the crust. So we are very, very lucky in one of our observations that we think we found this radial overtone. And that tells us what the crust thickness should be. Now, the value that we've got is actually much thicker than we thought. It's on the borderline of what was thought possible.
That presumably means it's more likely to be a neutron star as opposed to a strange star.
Actually, well, yes, it essentially gives you a very, very low mass. So it's actually quite borderline for a neutron star as well. It makes the mass about 1.2 solar masses, which is getting pretty small, but these are unusual objects. So maybe one of the reasons they're unusual is because they have such small mass and such high fields. So we're not quite sure what it means yet. Again, we need to refine our calculations. But if we have the crust thickness, as well as all these other frequencies, that's great because it actually lets us put really, really tight constraints on what the nuclear physics is doing. So I think as we get more confident in our models, this is going to be a really promising way forward.
How can you be sure that when you look at the data that you get, the frequencies that you're observing are in fact due to these radial overtones and not due to some other kind of movement on the star?
Okay, so there are two things. One is simply to ask, well, what are the right types of vibration I can excite? Okay, so the fact that we think these are twisting motions rather than motions in and out is because doing motions in and out is very, very difficult against this strong gravitational field. Mm. Okay, so we think that we are seeing some kind of essentially sideways vibrational motion. So that narrows things down. So the other reason is simply that it is so much higher than all the other frequencies. Okay, it's exactly where modelling puts it. So we've essentially made neutron star crust models, people have made predictions for where this frequency should be, and it's extremely close to where we expect it to be. And we really don't know anything else that could be around there. I mean, I guess if someone came up with a different model and said, no, actually, this type of vibration would also fit, then that would be fine. But right now, we have no other candidates for what it is that we're seeing.
That's a spectacular measurement to make. The crust of a neutron star, its thickness, that's fantastic.
It is.
We wish you all the very best in your research and we hope to hear the answer soon. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.